Good. So, welcome to Social Computing, Social Gaming. Today, as you already saw on behalf of those slides, we're going to deal with Gaussian mixture models, at least for the first part. And for the second part, we're going to devote ourselves to this nice review paper by Mark Newman, as I said. And we'll be talking about real-world networks and their statistical properties. Okay, good. So for the moment being, why did we arrive here and what did we do last time? Okay, so last time we talked about data mining techniques. And one of the most prominent data mining techniques that's out there to find groups with respect to profile elements is clustering, right? So what we had was this graph clustering. So given a, social graph, social network, and we dealt with finding subgraphs that were dense in a certain sense. And there we had these prototypes and we had this clustering paradigm, which we then took over and modeled as objective functions. And these objective functions we would then optimize with appropriate gradient, greedy, or other optimization techniques. So that was what we had. And then we said, okay, good. It's also possible to find groups with respect to their profile elements. And profile elements contained everything that's imaginable, from low dynamics, things like names and age and years and so on, to higher dynamic things such as locations, velocities, and so on. And all these things could be clustered. And I gave you several examples from research how to kind of process the results of these procedures and algorithms. We talked about k-means clustering, which used a simple idea of prototypes and alternating optimizations. Then we said, okay, good, k-means is certainly a crisp clustering algorithm. What about fuzzy clustering algorithms? Could you what can we do with them? And then we came up with fuzzy c-means, right? And fuzzy c-means was just a slight variant by just changing the objective function according to taking the power of the membership matrix elements. And then we said, okay, good, fuzzy c-means has its drawbacks in terms of that it just favors spherical clusters. And so that's why we ended up here in terms of talking about Gaussian mixture models. Okay, good. So what is a Gaussian mixture model? So in essence, a Gaussian mixture model is a probabilistic form of clustering. And so in that case, we assume for the moment a two-dimensional feature vector, right? So that could be anything like a location in two-dimensional space or something else. And the probability for each location would be given as a linear combination of Gaussian functions with these weights, which we denote as pi k. Okay, so this n, that was also something that was on the blackboard last time, are simple Gaussian functions, and in that case, multivariate Gaussian functions, because we're talking about 2D features. So that means that the centers of the Gaussians are not just points on the real plane, but that are points in R2, right? So mu k then would be, oh, thank you. Want to get my pointer back. Thank you. Thank you, Microsoft. Thank you. Thank you so much. So this mu k here is a 2 vector, and this sigma k, this covariance matrix, is a 2x2 matrix. Okay. And the respective functional form was that it's proportional to an exponential function of 1/2 and there we'd have x minus mu, and that's a two vector, and that's also a two vector transpose, and sigma to the minus one, that's the inverse of a 2x2 matrix, x minus mu, right? So that's basically what's in the exponent, right? And this takes the role of this 1 over sigma squared that we have in the 1D case, okay? And this sigma matrix, this covariance matrix, just tells us about the form of the Gaussian. So in... Hi, guys. The show is going on here. If you just talk, there's no need to be here, right? It's not logical. And guys, keep on telling me, please interrupt those people that talk all the time because they feel disturbed and I feel disturbed. Okay? Is that understood? Cool. Perfect. Thank you. So the centers of these Gaussians are those vectors here. And the question is, what are the isolines of these Gaussian functions? Yeah. How are they rotated? What's their extension in each direction? Right. So if you have a 2D Gaussian function that has a center somewhere, you can have a, well, symmetrical Gaussian head, so the case when these are all circles, right? But you could as well have something where we'd have the same center and have elongated ellipses as the isolines. So that would be a Gaussian head that's squeezed in that direction. And that's all in these matrix elements, right? And you could also encode that this is rotated, right? So a third version could be something like this, okay? And these are all, as I said, encoded in this matrix. So in the higher dimensional cases, the form of the Gaussians is a bit richer than in this just 1D case, right? So and in that drawing here, we have three Gaussians, which are, well, responsible for generating the probability density function here, okay? And they're all combined via these coefficients pi k. And the whole idea now is if we use Gaussian mixture models for clustering, we would assume that we would first have to agree on the number of clusters that we're after. And for each cluster, or each cluster is represented or modeled by a multivariate Gaussian. Okay. So, and then these pi k we would later on see are, can be interpreted as, yeah, class prior probabilities in a certain sense, right? So while the green Gaussian might be responsible for this region predominantly, we could still weigh this green Gaussian much less than, for example, the red Gaussian. And in that fashion, we can pretty much model any geometric situation that we want, provided that we use these ellipsoidal types of modeling, right? So in the 2D case, right, we would have our R2 here in that plane, right? And then the Gaussians are something that lie here, and maybe there's another Gaussian that's very flat that lies here, and so on and so on. And these are all added up so that a smooth surface is the result, and that smooth surface is then the probability density function, okay? And for clustering, we assume that each of those Gaussians creates points, right, that it will be responsible for. And our goal would then be to learn back from our given set of points these Gaussians. In essence, the learning problem is to estimate the mu k, the sigma k, and the pi k, right? So as for the mu k, we've seen that in k-means, right? So these are nothing else but the cluster prototypes, right? The centers of the Gaussians would correspond to the cluster prototypes of k-means. And these weights, as I said, would then would then model something that I call, or that they call, responsibilities, right? And in that fashion, you have a set of points that's down here in the plane that is like has some geometrical form, and then you would learn Gaussians that kind of fit these points accordingly. Yeah, so, and that's the whole process. And then in that way, we can later on interpret the responsibilities as something like fuzzy cluster membership degrees. Okay, that's the whole point. And why am I telling you this? Okay, so this will be our first and presumably last glance at machine learning, right? Because clustering can be perceived as a sub-discipline of machine learning, and the other sub-discipline would be something like classification. Those that have been to machine learning courses might know that already. And I want to introduce you to Gaussian mixture models because they're very versatile. They can be used for audio processing as well as for processing other socially relevant entities. And last but not least, the learning procedure for Gaussian mixture models is the expectation maximization algorithm, which is quite a classic in machine learning. So I would advertise just following that and taking out the spirit of these derivations, because that's something that you would occur all the time or you would stumble upon all the time in machine learning, right? Good. And as I said, for those games engineering students that are not so familiar with probability theory, still the offer is there that I teach you one or two lessons about basic probability if you want. Okay, good. So, a thing about notation. So, overall probability density function is usually written as P of X given the thetas, and the thetas would note all of the parameters that we want to learn, right? So that's a typical parametric learning thing. We have the functional form of our model. That's a given. And the machine learning procedure just corresponds to learning its parameters. Okay. And a non-parametric model that we've seen is, in a sense, this DB scan, which can also handle moon-shaped clusters and so on, which this model cannot because we are restricted to Gaussian ellipses, in a sense. Yeah. And this conditional density notation here means that we want to have the conditional probability density function of X given the parameters. And that's a typical formulation which would gain its strengths, particularly when you use Bayesian machine learning, yeah? Because then you would also assume probability density functions for these, right? And then integrate over them, okay? So what we will do is much easier. That's maximum likelihood, and that's just a point estimation for these parameters, yeah? Bayesian learning is a bit more clever because point estimates would not say anything about something that happens outside of some maximum, but the Bayesian methods actually do, right? So this is just a notation in a certain sense, okay? Good. So as always, I take this out of one single background reading source, and that's Christopher Bishop's book, which is called, Pattern Matching and Machine Learning. Basics of, I don't know, but Bishop's book is one of the classics, right? And I put the respective parts, the chapter on mixture models and expectation maximization on Piazza, so you can download it and study it. It's a very well-written text, okay? Good. So basics about machine learning, right? So we start with some model, like this Gaussian mixture model here. It is parameterized by a set of parameters, which we subsume under theta. So theta is just the set of all parameters that you want to learn. And the usual situation is that you have some data, and that's the data that you're given. In this case, two-dimensional vectors. That could also be 100-dimensional vectors or something else. And what we always assume is that these data are kind of drawn independently from this probability distribution that's given or that's symbolized by this probability density function, right? And this IID is very important because then we would have that the probability for the whole data set is just the product of the individual probabilities. Yeah. So identically, independently drawn. Yeah. So for each of those small x, we draw it from this probability distribution, right? And that results in the fact, because they're independently drawn, that you can later on just compute the product to find this, right? And this is the one that we are going to use to learn the parameters. And that's a super standard procedure that you'd find all the time in machine learning, right? So you have a generative model, and then you learn the parameters. And this thing, P of X given theta, is also called the likelihood, and that's the likelihood as a function of theta. So how likely is it that this value results if theta is such and such? Yeah. And a straightforward way to learn the thetas is maximum likelihood, meaning that our point estimation for the thetas is just the maximum of this likelihood as a function of theta. Yeah. So if some theta would deliver a small value and another theta would deliver a high value, what we would see is that this theta that delivers a high value for the likelihood best explains our experimental data that we have, okay? And that's always the goal that we want. And that's the simplest thing that you can do, right? There is also maximum posterior as a learning technique. There is Bayesian learning as a technique. And these are much more advanced and have their pros and cons, but maximum likelihood is still the most used thing in machine learning, I'd say. Yeah. And instead of just computing the gradient of this function and setting it equal to zero, what you would normally do is to take the logarithm of this expression instead of the expression itself. And this has the advantage that this product would turn into a sum, right? And then you'd have a much easier time computing the gradient. Yeah. So that's a pretty standard technique. And the other, advantage of this logarithm is, since we're working with Gaussians, the logarithm would just erase this exp, right? And then we would just have to deal with these linear terms later on. Yeah, and that's pretty convenient in our case. Good. So, simple example, right? So, assume that your generative model for the data is not a Gaussian mixture model, but just one single Gaussian, right? So, what you do is you have these points still, and you're not going to try to model them with two Gaussians, right? These are your points. You just want to model it with one Gaussian, right? That's somehow rotated, somehow skewed, has its mu somewhere, yeah? So that's a much simpler learning problem, okay? And now we're not having the sum over the various Gaussians, but just a single one. And this is the explicit formula that we have, okay? And we just want to say how maximum likelihood works in this case, right? So first we take the logarithm of that likelihood, and the thetas are just one n-dimensional center, a mu, and a just one n by n covariance matrix that we have to learn, right? So that's n squared plus n many parameters. Okay, in the case of R2 that we pursue all the time, we would have to learn six parameters. Two for mu and four for the for the covariance matrix. Okay. Now, taking the logarithm, and here we use the normal E as a base, so we take the logarithm ln. What we would get is this term here, yeah, just by taking the logarithm. And computing the gradient of this would yield the following results. Okay, so for mu ml, we would have to compute the derivation with respect to each element of mu of our expression here, right? And the same is true for the matrix sigma. We would have to compute the derivation with respect to each matrix element of this one. Now, these formula might irritate you because usually the derivation operator is only defined with respect to a scalar quantity. So you can have d to the dx, and x is just 1x, right? And what happens if x is a vector? Yeah. So, in essence, this is just a shortcut for the normal gradient, right? And this you would have to compute component-wise. And those that might be irritated by these, matrix calculus formula, and there is a thing that's called the matrix cookbook. And it contains a lot of formulas to just deal with these things, just for those that want to dig deeper into that, right? And a nice exercise is to compute that on your own. And the result of setting this equal to zero is the following. So for the center of the Gaussian that we're looking for, we would just have the center of gravity of all our points that we have as training examples, right? And that's only logical. If you want to find this center here for your Gaussian, what you do is you take all the points, add them, and take the average value in a sense, right? And that's your mu. And that's really what we would intuitively think should happen, okay? And the result for the covariance matrix is just that, okay? And for those that know a bit about statistics, that's just the empirical covariance matrix, yeah? So if you're familiar with variance, yeah, then you can see that this actually is a straightforward generalization of that, okay? So that's pretty what you would expect. So if these points are very far apart, then the Gaussian must be very spread. And if the points, let's say we would look at this from above, and if the points lie like this, then naturally the Gaussian that you model would have isolines like that. Yeah. So just respecting the geometry of the data. Yeah. And that's pretty what machine learning is about, yeah? So you choose a model, and in that case, this model is just a Gaussian, a multivariate Gaussian, and you would fit that model with maximum likelihood. That's all you do, yeah? Naturally, there is more complicated variance out there, but that's the basic idea in machine learning, yeah? And what we see is that results can be pretty intuitive. Now, what do we do in case of a Gaussian mixture model? Now, here we don't have a single Gaussian, but we'd have large K of these Gaussians. In that case, large K is equal to 3. And there are additional parameters, and these are the mixing parameters, as you might call them. And these mixing parameters must add up to 1. Because as we will see, they can be interpreted as probabilities. And so that's the situation we're given. Okay, and now the question is, what happens here? And the answer is nothing much. Okay, so what we would just do is to compute same things, right? So we would take the logarithm and then compute the derivation with respect to all the parameters and set it to 0. Yeah, maximum likelihood. That's very straightforward. Now, in order to be notationally convenient, we would introduce this one of K representation, right? Now, what is that? So, first of all, we assume that these Gaussians here kind of represent or are associated with latent variables. Yeah. So the only thing that we're given is the data itself. And we want to fit a certain model. Okay. And I said what we assume is that each of the points that we find is assumed to have been generated by one of the Gaussians. Okay. But we don't know which. Okay. So if we're given a point that's situated here, we would just not know, has it been generated by the green or the red one, right? And you might say, well, but the Gaussians actually don't generate anything. You're just given the points, right? But yeah, that's true. But that's another typical machine learning thinking. So you assume a generative process that you assume to have generated the data, yeah, and then you would a posteriori learn back that mechanism, right? And so these latent quantities, so these latent associations are represented by these ZK variables, okay? And, okay, what you assume is that each of these small x has been generated by such a Z. And if we have K such Gaussians, it would just have been generated by one of them. And that we can encode by a K-dimensional vector, and this latent quantities are always called Z. And these vectors would just have a zero in the place where, or a one in the place where the respective Gaussian has generated the respective points, right? So for a given X, yeah, we can have that representation, and we know that the 1/3 Gaussian generated that point, okay? And that's called a one of K or one hot representation, right? So the probability that ZK is one is just given by these quantities pi k, yeah? So we know the point in question has been generated by some Gaussian, and the probabilities for each of them is given by the pi k, right? Cool. And we can denote this just by stating that the probability, the prior probability for this random variable Z is given in that form. So you multiply the pi k and you take the zk-th power. So since zk is a binary vector, the only thing that's left is one of the pi k's where the respective zk component is one. Okay. Now, another way of grasping the fact that some x has been generated by some Gaussian is that we can say the conditional probability of X, given that ZK is one, yeah. So we know that the kth Gaussian generated X is just given by that kth Gaussian itself, yeah. So that's the model thinking that we employ here, okay. And for the whole vector Z, we would have the product of all the Gaussians to the power ZK, so that only that Gaussian survives where ZK is one. Yeah, so that's just for notational convenience. Okay. Now, this pi x that we started with, this mixture model, would then be decomposed in that way. Yeah. So we know that we can write any probability density function in that fashion by summing out the latent quantities. Yeah. So that's just basic probability theory. right? So if you have two random variables, yeah, let's call them A and B, this is the joint probability distribution, right? And we know that P of A given B is just defined as P of A and B divided by P of B. Yeah, so that's just the definition of conditional probability, right? And we also know that PA is nothing but sum over all the B's of P, A, and B. Yeah? And we can write this P of A and B, for example, as P of A given B times P of B. Yeah? And that's clear by that definition, right? So in that sense, if you sum over all B, you would have P of A given B times P of B, right? That's just basic probability, and that's what happens here, right? So we summed out the B's, right, to get P of A, yeah? And in that way, we can get back our model, okay? That's just for notational convenience, that we are easier able to compute the derivations, okay? And a remark, so we have several observations. We have N IID observations, okay? And for each of those X, we have a corresponding latent variable Zn, yeah? So for each vector X here, we have a vector Z in that binary encoding that tells us what this point or which Gaussian this point has been created by in our model thinking. Yeah? And later on, naturally, we're not able to state that precisely. We're just able to state the probabilities that this point has been created by Gaussian 1 or 2 or 3 or 4. Right? That's the way we learn things. Good. Now, what you can do is, so we know that these probabilities P of X given Z is just the Gaussian itself, okay? Now, in clustering, what we're interested in is we're given some X, and we want to know what Gaussian has been responsible for that X, okay? That's just a membership, later on will lead us to a membership degree in the cluster that's represented by the respective Gaussian, okay? And that is just produced by applying Bayes' rule, okay? And simple Bayesian rule, if we would note that down one more time, yeah? So what we certainly know is that P of A and B, the common probability distribution, can be written as P of B given A times P of A, but it can also be written as P of A given B times P of B, right? That's just by applying these formula, okay? If you would see that immediately. Now, since these are equal, what follows is that P of B given A is just P of A given B times P of B divided by P of A, right? And for P of A, we can insert this formula here, right? So that's just what's on that slide precisely, just for the Z and the X, okay? Okay, and that would be called Bayes' rule. So if you just want to invert things, right? So first of all, we had X given Z, and now we're interested in Z given X, yeah? You would just have to employ Bayes' rule, yeah? And if you insert the respective quantities, you would get this expression. So the prior probability of ZK being 1, so the prior probability that Gaussian K was responsible is pi K. Yeah, not that it was responsible, just the prior probability of the Gaussian is pi K. P of X given Z is just the Gaussian in question. And in the denominator, you would just sum out B. Okay? That's precisely what we have here. And these things we would call gamma of ZK, and these are also called responsibilities, right? So what you do is the following. So the generative process that you imagine, yeah, for three Gaussians and two-dimensional vectors is the one that's depicted here in the first image, right? So the red points are sampled from the red Gaussian only. The green points are sampled from the green Gaussian only, and the blue points from the blue Gaussian. And each point is either fully red in the picture, fully green, or fully blue, right? But that's just how you imagine that data have been created, right? The reality is just that, right? So you're given just pink points, and you don't know which Gaussian these pink points have been generated by. That's just what you assume as an underlying process. And the only thing that you're able to, tell is for the membership degree in a certain sense, okay? So for those points, it's clear that the red Gaussian was responsible, but for those in between here, we just don't know. So there are some that have an RGB value which has red components, but also green ones. Yeah. Or in other words, here the responsibility of the green Gaussian is roughly the same as the responsibility of the red Gaussian, whereas for the extreme points, the responsibility for the red Gaussian is very high, and the responsibility of the green and the blue one is very low, right? And that's just how you would then come to this rather fuzzy picture that we drew down here, if it's still there. No, it's not. We already erased it. Yeah, so that you get this landscape formed by the Gaussian mixture model, right? And these are very important quantities because these are, in a sense, would correspond to the fuzzy membership degrees that we had, okay? Good. Now, just starting from the beginning, right? So maximum likelihood. What did we do? So we just took our original model, knew that we want to learn the pi's, the mu's, and the sigmas, and we would then use maximum likelihood. So compute the derivation and set this to zero, right? So, and what we said was we take the logarithm, because the logarithm would turn the product coming from the IID into a sum here, right? But what we already see is that this summation here, the mixture ring, is inside the logarithm. And that's something that'll cause us problems, yeah? Because in the case of single Gaussian learning that we had here, there was no such thing, because the logarithm just eliminated the exponent here, the exponential function, and we're left with easy formula. Now, in the Gaussian mixture model case, this is not the case anymore. We'd have this sum inside the logarithm. And that's difficult, as we will see. Okay. But what we can still do is we can compute the gradient with respect to the pi's, the gradient with respect to the mu's, and with respect to these matrix element, set it to zero, do some algebra, and that's just what comes out. Okay. So let's interpret that. So the mu k, the cluster center of Gaussian k, would be given by the center of gravity by just adding all the points. But now we would have this membership function, in a sense, that would weigh these points. Yeah. So in order to compute center for the red Gaussian, you would take all the points, even those blue ones, but weigh them with the responsibility of the red Gaussian. So for this point here, for this blue point, the responsibility is very low. So the weight would be very low and it wouldn't contribute much to computing the center. In essence, it's just a fuzzy version of computing the center of gravity, right? It's completely analogous to what we had before. And you would just divide by the number of points that are associated with the kth Gaussian, and that is computed by just adding up the memberships, right? So that would be a non-integer in most cases, right? And for the covariance matrix, we find the same expression as before, but again, weighted with this membership, yeah? And that's the only difference to the single Gaussian case, in a sense, yeah? So you might say, okay, come on, that appears to be quite easy, yeah? But so where's the difficulty? Now, the difficulty is, these are the expressions for the gammas, yeah? And the expression for the gammas use the parameters already, right? But in order to get the parameters, you would have to know the responsibilities, right? So that's a dilemma, yeah? So which one are you going to compute first? The responsibilities or the mu, sigma, and pi's? And the answer is, you're going to do it just exactly as in k-means, with alternating optimization, yeah? So you start with a random assignment for the mu's, the sigmas, and the pi's, compute the responsibilities, go back to compute a new version of the parameters, a new version of the responsibilities, new version of the parameters, dang, 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 until the whole thing converges, yeah? And that's precisely what the expectation maximization algorithm does, right? So here again, so the problem is that these equations depend on each other in a complicated fashion. And this dependency is a result of the sum appearing inside the logarithm, yeah? So the logarithm cannot decouple the single Gaussian contributions, yeah? Because, you know, there is no such rule as logarithm of the sum is the sum of the logarithms. That's not what's right, yeah? And that's the reason why these things are complicated. So the idea, alternating optimization, first compute the gammas using the parameters of the previous iteration, and then compute the parameters of the current iteration using the, and it should read T here, right? So these that you that you computed here, right? So we can already improve that. Oops. Yes. Good. Good. So that's that. And that was basically all there is to Gaussian mixture models, in a sense. Yeah? So to sum it up, why did we do that? Okay. We wanted to have a fuzzy clustering algorithm that could handle non-spherical clusters, and the Gaussian certainly can via the shape of their covariance matrices. So you can have elongated clusters as well as compact spherical ones. Yeah? And the analog to the fuzzy membership that we had in fuzzy C means is these responsibilities gamma of Z and K. Yeah? So Z and K is the latent variable that kind of formalizes what Gaussian has been responsible for generating pattern N. Yeah? Was it K? Was it K minus 1, K plus 1, whatever. Yeah? So these are one of K encodings of these latent process variables. Okay? And so that's the way it proceeds, right? So let's assume you're given the green points, yeah? And you somehow guessed that you would have two clusters, right? Remember, this is typical for clustering algorithms. You would have to input the number of clusters, okay? Not for DBScan and not for some others, but for this class of clustering approaches, you would have to, okay? And still, if you don't know about the correct number of clusters, what you can do is compute this for several Ks, large K, and then try to find that one that has the highest model likelihood, for example. Okay, good. So you have the green points, and you know that there shall be two clusters. So you start with these random assignments of the parameters, mu, sigma, and K. Yeah. So mu1 is a two vector that's here, and for the second Gaussian, it's a two vector that's here. And the covariance matrices are just diagonal. Yeah. So the Gaussians would be spherical. Now then, you use these parameters to compute the responsibilities, right? And since the Gaussians are positioned as they are, this side would go to the blue side, and this would go more to the red side, okay? And then you would recompute your parameters, mu, sigma, pi, and these, right? And that would lead to two Gaussians that look completely different. They have their centers adjusted, yeah, and they have their covariance matrices adjusted, right? And then you go back and you compute the new responsibilities. With the new responsibilities, you compute the new values for the centers and the covariance matrix, and so on, until you reach convergence, right? And having a converged Gaussian mixture model allows you, if you have a new point, allows you to state precisely what the responsibilities for each Gaussian are, okay? And that, as you can see, is just a clustering in a sense. You're given the green points, and you fit a model to the green points that represents your clustering, okay? And once again, these Gaussian mixture models are used for so many things in social signal processing that you can consider them, well, an integral part of social computing in a certain sense, yeah? So social computing draws a lot upon machine learning. If you, well, kind of look at the papers that appear in social computing conferences, about half of them would be on social signal processing and use machine learning, whereas the other one would use, for example, traditional social network analysis methods, right? Just to give you an example, right? So that's why we're looking at that. And I can only advertise, try to deal with these things, try to compute them, right? It's worth the effort. Right. So the general expectation maximization algorithm, I just copied from Bishop's book to just be complete, yeah? So expectation step, evaluate the responsibilities. Maximization step, re-estimate the parameters using your new value for the gammas, okay? And in order to decide upon convergence, you would have to monitor whether the likelihood significantly changes, okay? If the likelihood doesn't change anymore, you can pretty much stop learning, okay? So that's how you would monitor your progress, okay? And there's also a general view on the expectation maximization algorithm where you would have a very general model, needn't be a Gaussian mixture model, can be something else, can be other mixture models, and you would still have the latent variables and your pattern variables, right? And that's also extremely typical. So that's the thing that you can, yeah, well, in a sense, fit because you have your data, and you would do so by summing out the latent variables, just as we have it on the blackboard here, yeah? Summing out the latent variables, yeah, would give you the probability density function for your original patterns, right? And you might say, come on, why do we do that stunt? Can't we model this directly? Well, the Zs are what corresponds in the Gaussian mixture models to these component responsibilities, right? So these are what you think or what you imagine to have generated your data. And latent models have really a very, very important significance. For example, assume that you have some people and you would have to kind of compute what topics they're talking about. So that's an example that I gave you, I guess, two lectures ago, okay? And if you want to do that, you can assume that some topics have generated your texts, yeah? And what you want to do is you have your text and want to recompute the topics, in a sense. You're interested in the Zs, in a sense, but this is what you need to assume for the learning process, okay? And still, for this general formulation, we would still have the sum inside of the logarithm, which causes the problems, okay? So if we knew the complete data set, so if we knew for each X here, taking this picture, if we knew this, okay, we would know everything. Yeah, so we can have the probability for each data point, and we also know the Gaussian that created that data point. Okay, but that's not the case. We said because the only thing we know is the patterns, and we assume that there has been a latent process generating those patterns, and then we can later on recompute the responsibilities of the respective latent components, yeah? And that's precisely what's expressed here, yeah? So if we knew the complete data set, we would be fine off. We could solve this distribution here and then determine these theta via maximum likelihood directly, yeah? But that's not possible, okay? So the only thing we know is these responsibilities, P of Z given X, yeah, which is just the Bayesian turned around version of X given Z. Yeah. And one thing to circumvent this in this theoretical framework is instead of dealing with this probability density that we don't know, we just know its functional form, but we just don't know it precisely. Yeah. What we compute is the expectation of this quantity using this probability density, right? So in essence, this is what we use. So we compute the expectation of this quantity, the logarithm of the joint probability distribution, using the responsibilities as probabilities. Yeah. And then we will see that this precisely corresponds to the Gaussian mixture model responsibilities, and in the M step, we would compute our new parameters. Same stuff, but this is just the general version. Yeah, for that, that's valid for any mixture model that you would want. Yeah, and if you insert the respective quantities, you would precisely see if you can. Let's just drop that for the moment, that you get your old responsibilities and things back. Okay, so it's worth thinking about this if you're interested in theory, right? Now, you might wonder, okay, good, got the point. So fuzzy C means is nice, but we would rather use Gaussian mixture models. What about K means and fuzzy C means? Is there a connection between these things? And the answer is yes. If you, K-means in a sense is just a degenerate version of a Gaussian mixture model, okay? So if we use a Gaussian mixture model with K Gaussians, where you would restrict the guys, if you talk all the time, I'm getting nervous, okay? It's no use. Right? I don't want to have that. People don't want to have that as well. Understood? Cool. Perfect. So if you restrict your covariance matrices to a diagonal matrix, yeah, then you would have this much simpler forms here, okay? And the responsibilities would also be much simpler. And if you would then take the limit process of letting this radius of the spherical Gaussian go to zero, yeah, you would have your k-means algorithm back. Yeah? So the mu's are still do still represent the cluster, but you're not making any statements about the width here. Yeah? So you just represent your cluster by the center of gravity of the respective points, and the extension, you don't care. Okay? So if you take this expression and let epsilon go to zero, we would have this type of softmax function, as it's called in machine learning, right? So in essence, your expectation of this quantity here is just the objective function of k-means that we have, okay? And only those clusters, or only that precise cluster that has the nearest distance to the point is then responsible. Right, so this responsibility shrinks to a delta function in essence. Okay, and so what you see is that these things are related in some sense. Yeah, so k-means was just some algorithm that we put forth and said, okay, it works, but it didn't have any theoretical justification except for the objective function. Okay, and what we see here is that this objective function turns out to be a special case of this general expectation maximization. Yeah. So, as I said, background reading in Bishop's book, and it's really worth digging yourself into that. That's just a start for those that have no experience with machine learning. It's a really a self-contained little piece of machine learning that I think is worth looking at. Yeah. So I can only advertise that for the moment being, okay? So that was that on data mining. So wrapping it up, if you happen to have a general model of actors and you happen to have profiles of these actors, and if you're interested in finding groups, may it be player groups or groups of people that you would want for a recommendation service or for a location-based social media service or whatever, you can use these methods to come up with estimates for the group memberships. Yeah, and that's really something that's typical for social computing. That's why I put this as an example on the slides. Okay, good. So now to a completely, well, slightly, completely, whatever you view that, a different topic, however, right? And the next chapter is about real-world networks, right? So we just left networks in terms of looking at, yeah, concrete profile data. And now we'll get back to them in terms of a completely different view. Yeah. So our network analysis efforts were restricted to computing centralities or computing subnetworks that are dense. But the question is, what about real-world networks? What about the graph of Facebook? What about the web, yeah, and its pages and its link graph? Yeah? Would we really want to compute clusters in the Facebook social graph with the clustering methods I introduced? You'd be having a very hard time. Yeah? So having a network of 1 billion nodes is something that you cannot handle, or at least would have a hard time handling with these simple methods that we looked at. And instead of that, we would look at statistical properties of these networks. And there we would come back to our 6 degrees of separation and all these nice properties of social and other networks. So over the last years, last 10 to 15 years, there has been a truly large paradigm shift. So before that, sociologists were just looking at small networks in the order of magnitude of 100 nodes. Yeah? So representing large families or communities that live in some rural area and so on and so on. And what they would be interested in would be to, for example, to compute centralities in order to say this is a node that has such and such a importance or such and such a role in that network, right? But nowadays, we would have like millions or billions of nodes. And what we are interested in is just finding a general model that, or on the one hand, we're interested in finding general models for these networks. And the second interest, which kind of coincides with that, is to find statistical properties of these networks, right? And types of networks that you would typically analyze are social networks. It's clear what that is. Information networks, for example, the web and its link graph, or ontologies, for example, taxonomies and so on. You can have technological networks, for example, the internet as a hardware network, or you could have biological networks, yeah? Nervous systems, vascular systems, biochemical pathways, things like that, right? And why are these interesting? Well, in a sense, they represent something like a macro social context, right? And until we had things like social media, where we could extract data from, sociologists would normally use laboratory experiments. Yeah? So they would go to people, present them questionnaires, let people answer the questionnaires, then do statistical tests or and some other typical experimental quantitative methods, right? But clearly, if you ask somebody about her or his life, you would introduce a bias. Yeah. So the typical bias is, if you ask people about their intimate lives, for example, they would try to exaggerate or deviate from the truth because these things are associated with, shame and other feelings that would kind of introduce this laboratory effect. Okay. But observing people in social media, so you think, you know that this has some ethical implications, which I cannot stop emphasizing. Observing people on the social web has the great advantage that you can observe them in their natural habitat, right? So you observe what they really do. And I already mentioned Alex Pantlin's book, which is entitled Honest Signals. Yeah, this is just a 200-page nice book about social signal processing. And that argumentation goes in the same direction. Yeah, so you don't observe people in the laboratory, but what you do is really observe their true behavior just mediated by the web. Okay? And so in order to be representative, what you would need to do is to observe large quantities of people. So hundreds, thousands, billions, millions, okay? And that's why we cannot naively use the methods that we introduced for these very large graphs, okay? And one example that we would look at, but that's just an example, is degree distributions that you would find, yeah? And typically, networks that you would analyze are citation networks. Yeah, so you have papers, and a paper cites other papers and is in turn cited by other papers. Yeah, and the resulting network is a citation network, which is in fact a tree, because no paper can cite papers that would appear in the future, right? So you don't have any cycles, and The question is, what are the degrees that are involved there? And you would find that citation networks as well as the web have power law distributions. So the probability of a random node having degree k is proportional to k to the minus alpha. Yeah, so that's a typical power law. And we will see examples for that, so that I won't draw that. Okay. And that's just one quantity that you might be interested in, or one model. So you kind of measure the degrees, yeah, by sampling large amounts of nodes and recording their degrees. And you would just plot these and then analyze whether they have such a power law distribution or not. Okay. Well, you might say, why would I be interested in degree distributions? I mean, does that tell me anything? And the answer is yes, it tells you something, because power law degree distributions are the result of preferential attachment, meaning that people with a high degree have a tendency to connect to other people that also have a high degree. And people with low degrees would associate with other people that have low degrees. And that's a behavior that you can observe at any given party, okay? So at any party, there are the super socializers that know everybody and that are in the center of attention. Well, and there are the bystanders, yeah, the nerds, if you want to call them as such, okay? And it's very typical that the bystanders associate themselves with other bystanders, whereas the super socializers would stay among themselves, yeah? And the same is true for money, yeah? So rich people associate themselves with other rich people and very many other properties. It could also be very relevant for games as well, because in MMOGs and other social games, you might want to kind of counteract that type of behavior in some sense by your game mechanics, for example, right? And this preferential attachment directly leads to power law networks, right? So if you measure that distribution, you can, via backward reasoning, kind of find arguments why you can assume that this network has been generated by a preferential attachment mechanism, okay? And that's something that's interesting in terms of understanding what the processes behind those networks are, okay? Other examples, if you have, as it's written on the slide, if you have a bipartite preference network, for example, there are people and there are movies, yeah? And an edge in that bipartite graph or network indicates preference of a person for a movie with a certain, yeah, weight, for example. If you analyze such bipartite networks, you can come up, for example, with a recommender system, yeah? And that's something that Wolfgang Wörndl lectures about. Yeah. So the easiest idea would be something like collaborative filtering that I explained to you some lessons ago. And there are more sophisticated recommender algorithms that make use of analyzing those networks in terms of latent quantities. Yeah. So you assume that some latent quantity generates families of these associations. Yeah. For example, typical cliche, yeah? A nerd likes science fiction films, yeah? And whatever, women that are very culturally interested like art house movies. And that's just a cliche. And if you want to kind of verify those cliches and want to analyze them, what you need to do is to come up with latent variable models for preference networks and so on, right? Another example could, for example, be word nets, yeah? And so if you just take a text and you would take the words as nodes and introduce an edge if some words are adjacent in the sentence, then you get a word network. You can analyze them as well. And the last example are those tripartite graphs, that would relate tags with authors and with items. Okay. So for example, a person has tagged a movie with a certain tag. And there's always these, three sorts of things that are involved. Okay. And these networks give rise to folksonomies. Yeah. And that's also something that's clearly relevant for social computing. And, if you formalize these, networks, for example, by counting the respective associations, then you can come up with a tensor structure that you can decompose in terms of latent variables. Yeah. And that's once again something that tells you a lot about the structure, the underlying structure of these graphs, right? And that's what you always do in these fields, yeah? So you come up with models, try to fit parameters and make statements about the processes that kind of generated these things, okay? And, other examples, so for technological networks, clearly, we have the internet that has been studied. We have power grid networks that have been studied. And that's something that is or will especially become important here in Germany concerning the Green Revolution, right? Alternative energies. So in the good old times when we had the nuclear power plants, yeah, I don't know if these times were so great, it was easy to serve every customer the amount of power that she or he required, right? Because you could precisely control the output of the power plants. But in a very decentralized green energy environment, you know that you cannot as well kind of guide how much, for example, a wind power plant or a solar power plant would generate, right? And in that decentralized fashion, the problem of kind of designing a power grid that is not susceptible to failures is a much more complicated task than in the old times where you would have these centralized power plants, right? And, other examples are, for example, traffic networks, right? And whoever has had the fun of driving a car in Munich, yeah, which is the most horrific thing I could ever imagine, knows that it's not so easy to kind of guide the respective traffic lights such that they would ensure a smooth flow. This is a complicated optimization problem. And since the underlying hardware network of the streets are immutable, right, you can learn a lot by analyzing these networks. Okay. And other things here in the science department are, for example, gene protein and protein protein interaction networks. And that's certainly something that's very interesting for bioinformatics, because in life science, you can only kind of shed light on a very limited domain happening inside cells, for example. Yeah? So if you're a life scientist and you're making your PhD, you would normally have a very restricted field of study. And putting together all these results would result in enormous information structures. And there's a lot of wisdom hidden inside these networks of entity interactions that you can discover by analyzing the respective networks, right? So here we have an example of drawing large networks, okay? So the first example is a drawing of predator-prey interactions, so like an ecological network. And this network here is a collaboration network between scientists, and this network here is in fact a network of sexual contacts between individuals, right, And so this is as this has been taken out of the paper by Mark Newman. And you might say, oh, come on, why do you have the last one? Is it just to be funny or frivolous? The answer is no, because if you're interested in STD spreadings, for example, you would have to analyze networks like that. And we'll come to disease spreading mechanisms at the end of next lecture, presumably. Okay. And what you already see is that for large networks, it's not particularly easy to draw them. Yeah, so the first drawing, the predator-prey network, is essentially worthless as an information visualization, right? Because you see some nodes that appear to be arranged in some circular fashion. Why? We don't know. And you see a lot of edges, but you just cannot follow a single one, because that's just a spaghetti mess of edges, right? And these things have been drawn by a spring embedder algorithm, yeah, where you would assume spring forces between the nodes and then compress the whole thing virtually and let go. And then it would arrange itself in a more or less optimal fashion that you can project, or you would work in the 2D domain from the beginning, right? But that's not the answer, right? So if you have a network of, let's say, a million nodes, right? What you would normally do first before applying any network analysis methods is to draw the network. And that can be done for 100 nodes. Yeah? And by drawing, by using information visualization, you can employ your eye as a clustering tool. And the eye is an excellent clustering tool where you would be able to see any structure with very little effort, okay? But with these networks, which have 1,000 or 10,000 or a million nodes, just drawing them is pretty useless, yeah? So, well, this is another justification why we would want to have these statistical properties describing the networks and describing the mechanisms that created those networks, right? So if you're an ecologist and you just want to reason about predator-prey equilibria and dynamical processes in that ecological niche, you would want to know whether this is, for example, an assortative mixing network or a disassortative mixing network and so on, right? So drawing networks is a complicated thing, and I have some slides on that. Maybe we could come back to that later, okay? So what we just want to know now is to investigate a series of properties, or in other words, classification axes for complex real-world networks, okay? And one thing is to just take the network data that you crawled from the web and compute descriptive statistics. Another thing is to understand the processes, as I said, that generated them. And this is mostly done by comparing the true network to a random graph model that you make of the network, right? And if both coincide, then in some sense, you understood something. We'll get back to this. Okay, so for the last 10 minutes, just an introduction to some of the quantities that we might be interested in. So remember the fourth or so lecture when we talked about the 6 degrees of separation phenomenon, right? So knowing each person knows each other, or each other person by around 6 degrees at most, okay? So what you might be interested in is the average path length, the mean average path length in such a network, right? And that's the way you compute it, right? Straightforward. So if you're given a network and you would have to compute the path distance with some appropriate algorithm, and then you would take just the average of those path distances, right? So here we assume that we have a symmetric network, so an undirected one. And this is just, so the sum over Dij is just compared to the numbers of nodes, numbers of pairs that could be there, right? Now this plus one here is just because in that formula, you would count the distances from a node to itself, which are actually zero. So you would have to be to compute a half times n plus one instead of the usual half n minus one. Yeah. But this is just for computational convenience. So if you leave out those contributions from the node to itself, which is this n, then you would precisely get your usual formula back for normalizing this. Okay. Now, the problem with that formula is that when, in cases when your network falls apart into disjoint components, yeah, then this cannot work because the distance between two nodes that are in different components would be infinite, right? So the whole measure would be infinite. And in order to avoid that, instead of the arithmetic mean, you can take the harmonic mean, right? So by doing that, naturally the distances that are infinite don't contribute anything. Yeah, that's just another way to come up with the notion of average path length, okay? And having that quantity, which is utterly straightforward, what you can now do is, for example, take some random graph model and let it generate a million nodes and then record this quantity and see whether it matches the quantity that you computed from a real network. Yeah? And if you're able to match your random graph model with, let's say, 5 or 10 of these measures, yeah, then you would have an argument towards stating that this random graph model is a good generative model for that social or nervous or whatever network. Okay, that's just the way things proceed here in that part of science. Yeah, and it's incredibly successful. Yeah, so there have been lots of new inventions in that field over the course of the last 15 years or so, and even Nature papers appearing that study these networks, right? Good. And, well, shall we do that? Okay, let's just do that. Second measure that you might be interested in is measuring transitivity, okay? So what is transitivity? Let's assume I am the friend of Christian, and I'm also the friend of Michael, right? Then intuition tells us that Christian and Michael also have a high probability of being friends, yeah? Because they're in the same circle, okay? And if that is the case, yeah, if you happen to have a higher probability, if you have nodes like that, if you happen to have a higher probability of transitivity than not having this, so that's me, and that's Christian, and that's Michael. So the question is, are they connected or are they not connected, typically, in the network, right? And as I said, me, Christian, and Michael are of no interest whatsoever. It's only of interest in the long run whether this is the case in the network or not. Okay? And what you can compare is whether, what, how many triples in that sense are there compared to, or what the number of triangles, sorry, the number of triangles in the network compared to the number of connected triples that you have in your network, right? This is a connected triple, okay? And if the number of triangles multiplied by 3, because a triangle can give rise to 3 different triples. That triple, or that triple, or that triple, right? So we have to count each triangle by a factor of 3, yeah? And if that is the same as the number of connected triples, we know that there's perfect transitivity, okay? So each pair of my friends is also friend for sure, okay? And it's interesting, this quantity is interesting because it's a distinguishing quantity that distinguishes social networks from other networks, right? In social networks, you have a high probability of transitivity, whereas in technological networks or random graph, simple random graph models, this quantity is orders of magnitude smaller than in social networks. And since this also corresponds to how clustered the network is, in a sense, yeah, because if every of my friend is also friend, then this gives rise to clique-like structures. That's why this thing is called clustering coefficient. Yeah, and as I said, it's an interesting measure because it helps us analyzing or telling social networks apart from others. Okay. Now, this is a global measure, and Watts and Strogatz, two persons that have made a large contribution by coming up with a model for social networks, these two have a local variant. Yeah. So CI is the number of triangles connected to some vertex, divided by the number of triples centered on that vertex, right? And then the clustering coefficient for the whole graph is just the average of these local clustering coefficients, yeah? So instead of taking the average of the mean, we would take the, this is the average of the mean. We would take here the mean of the averages, right? But in essence, these things measure the same quantities, yeah, just with a slightly different notion. And the values are slightly different for given networks, but they're comparable, right? So you can use either that you would want to use, okay? So these are just two examples that we have, mean average path length, clustering coefficient, and we would find that there is lots of other measures. For example, is there a giant component? What assortativity pattern does the network have? And so on and so on. And if you have an array or vector of these measures, you can characterize a network statistically. And that's what you're after in this case, right? And you might ask yourself, why would I want to know that? So the goal would still be that you can read papers in the social computing field, or for the gamers, apply social computing techniques and assessments to the game domain later on. Okay. So in order to be able to read a paper, you would need these things as a vocabulary. Yeah, so you would need to know what a power law network is, what a scale-free network is. It's just basics. And the basics are what we're going to cover. Okay. Last thing, assignment 3 for the games engineering students and their lab course is precisely dealing with these quantities in the right fashion. Yeah. So in order to be able to identify gold farmers, you need to apply social computing measures, and these things that we have in that survey paper here are also nice to solve the assignment. Okay, so tomorrow we will be digging deeper into that, and we will find reasons for the fact that Natalie Portman has a low Kevin Bacon number as well as a low Erdős number, right, if someone is interested in Natalie Portman at all. However, and we'll find more of these interesting measures that tell us something about real-world networks. Okay, so see some of you, some brave warriors of you tomorrow at 8, right? The others, see you in the recording. Okay, so...